Today is Wednesday. It's September 28th, 2022. It's 2:44 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are frequently broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio. Not every Saturday night, but we're there a lot when the schedule allows, and you can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm A.D. Quigg. I'm a government and politics reporter at the Chicago Tribune, where I cover mostly the Cook County Board, but also Chicago City Hall and the Obama Presidential Center.
I'm Eric Zorn, the former Tribune columnist who now writes the Picayune Sentinel Substack newsletter, and I'm slightly indignant today.
By the way, A.D., you haven't done this with us before, but I always have a template for what we're going to talk about. Then Eric always does something like that, and then we have to say, hey, Eric, what are you indignant about?
I'm only slightly indignant. I'm slightly indignant about the fact that Seinfeld is not in the top five TV shows of all time. And we're going to talk about that later. But I'm over it enough that I can talk about other things.
A.D., did you see that Rolling Stone list?
I sure did. I love lists like that, if only to argue about them, about certain rankings.
And, you know, I saw the list, and we will talk about it in a little while, but I thought all 100 of them belong there pretty much. There's some that should be there that aren't. We're saying elsewhere, for God's sakes. But I also wondered, Eric, did I misquote you when I said that while Cosby is not on the list of the 100 greatest shows of all time, did you say that it shouldn't be and I said it should? Is that fair?
That's kind of fair. I see the argument that it should be. There are, we can talk about it right now if you want.
Nah.
I feel like there are at least three shows that arguably should be on there because their importance as TV shows and their quality. One would be Louis C.K.'s show. One would be Roseanne, obviously Roseanne Barr's show, and of course The Cosby Show. Those were all, I think, they were high quality shows that had a big impact, and they're not on there because of misbehavior of various amounts of severity by their main stars.
Yeah.
But it's not only the stars that made those shows. It's all the
that's
the,
it.
It's the writers, it's the directors, it's the supporting cast. So it's entertainment, and it's a tough call. I understand, like, you know, it's Cosby is a very, very problematic figure,
and to say the least.
To celebrate him by a show with his name on it.
This reminds me of the conversation about statues and monuments in the city. You know, maybe it'll be on the list, but we'll have a plaque before the show saying, you're about to watch Cosby. He's a terrible person. And then the credits roll, and then you watch the show. I was walking a golf course on Lakeshore Drive this week, talking to a couple of smart, middle-aged pharmaceutical salesmen that I had just met. And they found out what I did for a living. And they asked, hey, have you heard about this thing where they're going to let all the prisoners out? And they said, are you talking about that on the radio? And I said, we talk about it every day. And they said, is it true? And then I told them, I don't think that's going to happen. Honestly, I was afraid that if I flat out told them that that's Loon Tunes crazy, that would seem partisan. And if I lobbied too hard for the truth, it would seem as advocacy. And I didn't want them to sort of take sides. So I tried to just walk them up to making the decisions themselves. I said, think about it. Do you actually think that on January 1st, they're going to open up the prison gates and let the people walk out? Now, I hope they saw the ad that J.B. Pritzker is running, which criticizes Darren Bailey's campaign tactics. He describes it as fear-mongering without solutions.
A viral snowstorm of misinformation online. Political ads disguised as newspapers. Darren Bailey and his allies incessantly spreading myths and obvious falsehoods. There is no purge law in Illinois. The law allows judges to keep violent defendants behind bars. Convicted criminals currently in jail will not be released. An entire campaign trying to scare you. Darren Bailey. All lies, no solutions.
I would encourage everybody to read my colleague Jeremy Gorner's kind of fact check of the claims around the Safety Act and the Pretrial Fairness Act. This is something that is not easily explained in a 30-second ad. The legislation itself is more than 700 pages long. But in essence, it was seeking to reframe the way that we consider holding people in jail, that we should not be holding people in jail simply because they could not afford bail, and that we should be keeping the most violent offenders in jail, regardless of how much money they have. I encourage people of this every time we get close to an election. if a claim is too straightforward to be true, do some Googling, and don't do your Googling on TikTok and Twitter. Go read stuff like the Chicago Tribune, Capital News Illinois also did a good article on this. Snopes has done a good article on this. Yeah. But it's difficult for someone like Governor Pritzker when something like this gets as out of hand as it has on social media to try to set this stuff straight in 30 seconds. And obviously, as Eric knows, when you're explaining, you're losing. And this has been going on for several weeks, so it's kind of interesting to see the governor just now getting into the ad space to defend
us. I wonder when he was going to start spending his money. I mean, JB can outspend Dick Uihlein or Darren Bailey if he wants, but he hasn't. And now he's fighting the fight.
Yeah, I thought it was strangely late to the game fighting this. I mean, the basic principle behind the Pretrial Fairness Act, which is a part of the larger Safety Act, is that you shouldn't have to spend time in jail just because you're poor, because you don't have enough money. You don't want to criminalize poverty. That's the idea. It doesn't really change so much the people who get let out or people who get to stay in jail before trial. It just makes it so that it shouldn't be based on how much money you have. So that if a rich person allegedly commits second degree murder, then they can just buy their way out, and a poor person has to sit in jail. That's un-American. That's wrong, and I'll argue to the end for that principle. There are some problems. Democrats even admit there are some problems with the Safety Act and how it defines the procedures for pretrial release. And they are, I think, right now working on trailer bills, right, AD, that they're talking about making some tweaks to the act. But that fundamentally, this is about reforms in the justice system, and it's about making sure that you're not criminalizing poverty. And I think if you put it that way to somebody, say, like, no, they're not going to throw – I mean, that you could have told those guys on the lakefront that, no, they are not going to throw the gates open and let people out on January 1st. They're going to have to reconsider some of these cases. People are being held because they don't have the money to get out. There are a number of cases where you can't get out no matter what, and the idea that that Bailey and the people who are behind him are trying to talk like all these crimes are – you can't hold people because they committed crimes like that. That's just not true. And as 80 point, I mean, Jeremy Gorner's piece, which was a week ago Monday. When was that? Do you remember when it was?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just spot on. Really, really well done. Lays out the arguments. Lays out the facts. He did a great job with it. And also, you know, PolitiFact, I believe, did a piece, as well as Snopes. There's a lot out there that what this legislation really does and what it doesn't do. And I think that once you read that, you realize that the changes are not frightening.
Well, I'm reading Gregory Hines in Chicago Business. Critics say someone accused of this is the critics of what you just said, Eric. Critics say someone accused of robbery, non-residential arson, vehicular invasion, drunken driving that results in death, second-degree murder, kidnapping cannot be held pre-trial. Why? Because those offenses are probationable, and the Safety Act limits pre-trial detention to non-probational offenses. You know, he doesn't add any other context to that. He quotes what the critics are saying about it and leaves it hanging there as though, in fact, that's true. That if you're on trial for second-degree murder, they cannot keep you. And if that's the case, that's troubling to people.
Well, it should be that troubling. Second-degree murder is on its own, just straight second-degree murder charge is very rare, as is a straight kidnapping charge. If it's aggravated kidnapping, which
well,
is what we
put,
tend
okay, but then put it in up. There. But then put that stuff in there. At least if it rarely happens, who cares? I mean, doesn't that strike you as at least an oversight on their part?
Well, I'll defer to AD on this, but I feel like there are – no, it may be one of the oversights, most of these cases, the idea is that is this person, if you're just going to hold him in jail because you think he did it or she did it and they don't have the money to get out, these crimes are bailable right now. So you're holding somebody in jail because they can get out anyway.
Yeah.
And we have this presumption of innocence and it's the bedrock of our justice system.
He does make the point in this piece too, that big time drug dealers can bail out all they, if it's just you have enough money. The mope selling dime bags on the corner goes to jail for months and months and months for that small crime compared to the guys that are bankrolling the whole affair, and they could walk the next day.
I'm hearing yes, we should be thinking about potential trailer bills. I think the question is going to be whether it happens before November, which I think is unlikely, or after, maybe in January. And I think the governor is going to have to continue addressing this, and I think he wishes he didn't have to continue addressing this. We've seen crime be way earlier in the summer. We heard Republicans ahead of the election season saying, we want top issue to be crime. And for a while, that issue shifted to abortion, which the governor would like to be talking about a lot more. And the governor would also like to be talking about his clean energy bill. So the more time we're talking about crime, the less Democrats are excited. But I think we are going to see at least promises for trailer bills to tweak this thing further. So we should watch out for exactly what is in those and how it addresses those concerns about what crimes are bailable and which ones require, either because of their violent nature or because someone is likely going to reoffend, how much those get tweaked.
Eric's been saying that he thinks the JB is going to win by a lot. In the last couple of weeks, some of us have been opining that we think it's going to be closer than Eric thinks. I'm looking at the Emerson College polling from September 21st to the 23rd. So this is about 5 days old, six, 7 days old. If the election for governor were held today, who would you vote for at this time? 51% said JB, 36% said Darren Bailey, 13% undecided. Eric had the margin at about 18%. This is about 16%.
You're 15, isn't it? You said 51 to 36?
Yeah.
51 to 36, yeah.
I had 18.
I think it's going to be closer than that.
Early voting does kick off pretty soon, which is like another wrinkle in this. Is like, given how much the news cycle moves, there's going to be people who are voting already, even though things could change a lot in the next few weeks.
Well, do you think that this is gaining traction? These flyers that are arriving in people's mailboxes and this ad campaign from people who play by the rules pack?
I can only judge by social media chatter, which is not a good thing to judge off of. I have not seen the polling on this, but I would expect so. I mean, this has been the talking point on just about everything I've been watching. I've seen something regarding the Safety Act pretty much every day for the past few weeks. And I think the debate over the fake news mailers also fueled some of that and actually distracted from some of it, because we spent a lot of time talking about whether it was fake news or not and what was in the mailers themselves and how they came about, and not a ton of time, well, a bit of time fact-checking, but probably not as much as I would like, or talking about the other aspects of the bill. So based on anecdotal, yes, I would say this is pretty prominent, but I would love to see some polling on this.
That same Emerson poll, my producer Pete just handed me this. This is from The Hill today. Which of the following issues is the most important thing in determining your vote this November? Is this Illinois, Pete, then? This is for our gubernatorial race or our general election coming up. Number one issue, economy, jobs, inflation, taxes, 35%. Number two on the list, the threat to democracy. I don't even
really
know what. How about that? I'm surprised. I don't know how that was generated, if they asked or people volunteered that. Abortion is 14 and crime is 10.
Abortion is the 14th most urgent
No,
issue?
It's 14%. I'm quoting percents.
Oh, okay.
36%, 16% is the threat to democracy. The number two item on this list, abortion is number three at 14.5%, and crime is number four on the list at 10%. Followed by other.
I wonder how much those have moved in recent weeks.
Don't you think it's a moving target?
It's the nature of polling. It's the nature of where the campaigns decide to direct their ad dollars. And if they're going to make crime a big issue, people are going to start thinking more about it.
Yeah.
The abortion being high up there, you can't necessarily say which way that is going to what that means. Because if you just say abortion, if the thing were like protecting a woman's right to choose, then that would be different than abortion, because you're going to get people on both sides of that debate pointing to abortion as a major issue for them. And same thing, I think, with this threat to democracy, although I would guess that that is more something that animates Democrats, given the I mean, you know,
well, really, if you think that votes are being stolen.
Yeah,
legally,
exactly.
Then, yeah,
it's funny, Eric, exactly. Because the threat to democracy, to me, that's a red flag for conservatives. But the abortion, to me, that would indicate that people are going to vote Democrat. I think the abortion issue more animates Democrats to get to the polls in Illinois and nationwide. Look what happened in Kansas.
Well, I don't quite understand why that question is asked in that way. It doesn't seem very useful to me. Like, I think you'd want to put a proposition, like I say, like protecting abortion rights or guarding election security, as AD put it, or you know, preventing the takeover of our government by white supremacists, things like that. You know, that you want. I think you need to be more specific if you really want to take the pulse of the electorate. I'm going to write a stern letter to Emerson College about this after we're done.
Well, it's sure, boy, that jumps out to me as that's the rally cry for people on the left to get out and vote, because they're the ones who are aggrieved right now. I mean, think about it. The abortion issue animated people before this Roe v. Wade change. Now that it's changed, I think the ball's in Democrats' court. I think that's a more animating issue for people on the left than it is on the right. Black Club Chicago's story this week about a proposal to keep Chicago alderpersons from earning outside income says that the effort is stalled. The measure would have prohibited them from working on real estate deals or provide legal services. The proposal is now languishing in committee. Alderman Nicholas Spizzato says that rather than not allowing this outside income, it should just be left up to voters. They should decide who they do or don't want on the city council.
My view on it is that any kind of employment that you have that creates any potential conflict of interest with your duties as a public servant, whether it's on the city council, state legislature, U.S. Congress, anywhere, you got to get out of that job. That you make a choice. When you enter public service, you make a choice. It's maybe it will require a sacrifice from you. But the aldermen and alderwomen on the Chicago City Council are paid pretty well. I think they're definitely six figures. I think it's 80, you may know this, but it's like 113, at least 113, right?
Yeah, it depends on seniority, but yeah, it's the low to mid 100s.
Yeah, that's a decent middle income, and when you run for the council, you know that. You're going to have to give up your law practice or your garbage hauling practice or whatever you've got.
Really? But wait a minute. You don't want them to have any outside income at all?
Well, no, I didn't say that. I said if there's a conflict, if you're you know, selling lemonade at the farmer's market or something, that's not going to harm it's going to create a conflict of interest. But there are certainly these. I mean, look at Burke, Alderman Burke. He's a property tax attorney. Look at former Speaker Madigan, these property tax attorneys. The conflicts there are unavoidable. I think that's wrong. And I think that if you were to ask the electorate if they would like to see this kind of ban on employment by elected officials, I think they would resoundingly say yes.
Well, why is it happening now? I think it's happening now because there are some progressive aldermen who would like to burnish their ethics credentials ahead of the 2023 municipal elections. Anytime there's a resurgence in folks getting indicted, this kind of rises to the top of everyone's minds on the city council. Alderman Joe Moore tried to do this back in 2019, and it similarly went nowhere. I have been following the ethics stuff on council pretty closely, and there's like a very interesting debate playing out about an outright ban or really thorough reporting and accountability, and either not being able to vote or carry legislation that has to do with the industry you work in, or not doing it at all. And there are quite a few aldermen who argue, hey, isn't a citizen legislator a good thing? Isn't it good to have attorneys who are still in the know, at least able to provide their insight and counsel to their colleagues about what's going on? So Alderman Howard Brookins, for example, who is retiring from the city council in part because the ethics board basically said, you have a conflict of interest representing folks who are suing the Chicago Police Department. Like, you represent the Chicago Police Department as a member of the city council, but also you're fighting against the police department in your private life. And he says, being in the trenches on this stuff makes me a better legislator because I know what's happening on the streets. I think there's a lot to be done in terms of reporting the current fiscal impact statements that K candidates and current city employees have to file is very lax. It's like barely any reporting. It's like kind of check this box if you do this with no detail. So I could see maybe some kind of compromise, do a lot more reporting and or you have to excuse yourself for the following things. But like you mentioned, this is stuck in Rules Committee and it might stay stuck there because that's where legislation goes to die.
What do you mean by reporting? What kind of reporting is that?
Every year, I believe, incumbent aldermen have to say, here is my side job, a little bit about what I make, and a little bit about my clients, but very little specificity about the nature of that work, where it intersects with potential council action.
Is there anything that prevents them, though, from having that? As long as they report it and disclose it, everybody knows, they can continue to do that, though, right?
They can continue to do that. There are provisions that say you have to excuse yourself from certain votes. So we saw Alderman Roderick Sawyer, for example, sometimes excusing himself because he has a private law practice. Alderman Burke, Alderman Patrick Daly Thompson, because of his family's ties with the insurance industry. I think that there's space for that to become a bit stricter and for the public to find a little bit more about what the nature of the work involves.
Yeah, I think the idea of recusals is not a bad one. I know on the radio the other day I was poo-pooing it because when you're on the council, you've got a lot of influence that may not be that obvious. But if you had full disclosures like that, I got no problem if there's a lawyer who's doing wills or adoptions is working on the city council. It's the problem when they're doing business that directly intersects with decisions that are made by the council or made by city government that the problems arise. And so if you had like a, I don't know, parliamentarian or someone who would, or even maybe the inspector general's office really, really bird dogging situation like that and saying like, look, no, you can't vote on these issues and we're going to delineate them right now so that you don't have to scratch your chin when these bills come up. We're just going to tell you right now, anything having to do with X, Y, and Z, you can't vote on. That would be okay, I guess. I mean, that would certainly get rid of a lot of the most brazen potential abuses.
Yeah, aldermen do hit up the ethics board quite a bit. We don't get to see all the ethics board's opinions on when and how aldermen should recuse themselves from certain things. But I'm intrigued by the idea of proactive watchdogging all the time rather than, hey, you voted on this thing and you shouldn't have, which is retroactive and doesn't really help address the corruption.
Oh, stuff. Right. Rather than, hey, you shouldn't be allowed to vote on that. We're not going to let you. But while you're intrigued by that, I'm also a little skeptical of that. That's asking, I don't know, the wolf to watch the chicken coop or something. I don't know who this person is that's going to score that. And then we have to have enough faith in the system to believe that it will be sufficiently proactive. I'm kind of cynical about that.
Yeah, as it stands now, you have to go to the ethics board. If you have a question about whether you can vote on something,
oh, you already did.
Vote on something.
But as you point out, the ethics board is sort of shrouded in mystery. We don't get to see a lot of the results of their work product. So
yeah, although going back to the idea of the parliamentarian, usually parliamentarian is like the did you make the motion properly type of person. But there have been also moves in council to have a parliamentarian to be like a very neutral umpire about when motions are proper, so that the mayor doesn't win every time. There's also a move for the city council to have its own general counsel, its own attorney, to kind of help with these bigger picture things too, again, so that it's not always the council siding with the mayor.
Hey, speaking of the mayor getting your way all the time, you mind if I hijack the podcast temporarily, John?
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask AD about the BGA, Better Government Association, is backing a proposal. They've written some things trying to convince members of the city council to pick their own committee chairs instead of letting the mayor do it. Now, according to the stories, that this is state law says that council should pick their committee chairs, and Robert's Rules of Order suggests that the city council should pick them. But it's tradition in Chicago for the mayor to name the chairs, and it seemed like a good idea to me, although I understand why the mayor has voiced her opposition to it.
Yes. And this is something that my colleagues and I, when I was at Cranes, I did a report with WBEZ and the Daily Line about how committees work and don't work. And this was in light of like how COVID had messed up so many things, in light of how few committee meetings were held when on really important topics that probably should have had some kind of a hearing. And the thing I always ask aldermen is, why don't you guys take over and figure out who runs committees, who chairs, who serves as chair and vice chair, what members are on committees. And it's basically like a lack of organization and agreement. They can't get their stuff together in a certain sense. No one has stood up and convinced enough fellow aldermen that it's a good idea.
Or that it's a big enough problem that it needs to be addressed.
Right. And there's that incumbency thing where the people who are already committee chairs would like to stay committee chairs. So they don't want to hop on the bandwagon and say, never mind, let's put this up to a vote of the council as a whole. I always look for evidence that council is doing a good job organizing itself. And the whole map debate, which was really ugly, was kind of evidence that it's very difficult for them to get together. A lot of them are leaving city council in part because it's been so difficult for them to work together and accomplish things. So even if they were granted, they don't even need to be granted this power. If the mayor said, go for it openly, and enough of them said, yes, I'm not even sure that they could organize themselves and come to an agreement. Just based on like how everything has gone in the past two terms of council.
Well, do we know what the process would be? Like anybody could nominate anybody and then they'd have runoff votes. How would they even do it?
The way Robert's Rules reads, it says the membership of aldermen on standing committees and the chairman and vice chairman of such committees shall be determined by the city council by resolution duly adopted. And that's about it. So there would be some open meetings things that they have to work around, but I could imagine caucuses or something getting together and saying, here's our proposal. What do you guys think? And kind of kicking it back and forth. I don't know.
The advantage, though, to being able to pick the committee chairs from the mayor's perspective is that she'll get somebody that will do her bidding, right? That will do what she wants. And the city council might be at odds with that.
It's not just doing favors for the mayor or stopping legislation that she doesn't want or moving stuff more quickly than she wants. It's also just like, we talk about aldermen being in charge of little fiefdoms, their own wards. And one thing they have very little power over is how much money they get from the city. And one way for them to get money from the city is becoming a committee chair. Sometimes most of them come with six-figure budgets. Some of them, like finance committee, are much higher than others. And having that budget allows you to hire more staff, which is like a very sweet sweetener for serving as committee chair and in some cases doing what the mayor would like you to do.
Well, if you want to speak on behalf of the mayor's position, you know that come election time, voters are going to hold the mayor accountable for a lot of what the council does. That, and the same thing with the school board and the police. Ostensibly, she's not directly in charge of those, the operation of those departments. But in the end, the mayor is going to be the one everyone's going to say, well, look what's happened to education, crime, and all the other things that these committees deal with, so that she would then lose the power to control her own destiny the way she does now. That would be the argument in favor of just like, let the mayor have control here so that we can hold the mayor accountable. Otherwise, you have 50 different wards. It's very difficult to hold a committee chair. Say you've got a committee chair who's screwed up the budget. How does the average voter in Chicago hold that person responsible?
Yeah, but where the mayor has like direct appointment power at Chicago Police Department, Chicago Board of Education, for now, City Council is supposed to be a legislative branch separate from the executive. And part of how we grade her is supposed to be, how well do you move your agenda through the City Council? And should that be because you are controlling who chairs committees or because you are a good negotiator who has solid relationships with the City Council?
What's your answer to that?
The answer, obviously, is that the voters don't know. The voters probably don't. I mean, does the average voter go, well, you know, the mayor picked that council, that committee chair. The question is opaque to voters.
Well, the mayor is very good at making her positions clear on who she likes and doesn't like and why.
Right. But I'm saying that in terms of like holding the mayor accountable for whether she's moving her legislation or not, I don't think voters go, you know, I can't blame Mayor Lightfoot for not moving her agenda for her because she didn't get to pick the committee chairs. And I think that's a level of sophistication and civics knowledge that a lot of voters just don't have. Huh. So are you laughing?
No, I'm thinking of the two guys on the golf course who can't figure out if those flyers they're getting in the mail are real or not.
Yeah. So basically, it comes down to, I believe, performance. People are going to grade the mayor on how she does on education, on crime, on the budget, on issues that buy, like speed cameras and all these other things. But all these things, the voters are going to hold the mayor accountable. And so the mayor wants to be able to pull as many strings as she can to try to achieve the result that she wants. So I see her point in being upset about the possible change.
This goes back to like a very interesting and fundamental discussion we've been having about the way city council is changing with like the end of patronage. We're kind of moving away from that fiefdom bit where aldermen are solely responsible for what happens in their ward, potholes, garbage pickup, and other things. And a lot of them are saying, we want to be legislators. We want to be influencing city policy. We want to be pushing back on the mayor. We want to be changing stuff. And I think part of that is also going to be the public coming up to speed and maybe having different expectations for their aldermen, pushing things through council, getting things through council, stopping the mayor on certain things, helping her on other things. It's a really interesting change. And I think it's only going to get crazier because we have so many senior aldermen who've been on council through going back to Daley and Rahm days that are leaving, and kind of like that precedent might be going away even more with this new crop of aldermen coming in.
R. Austin Burke talks about that on this podcast sometimes, that it's so much about constituent services and what you get for it, when in fact they should, rather than be task rabbits, they should be more involved in the legislative process, the governance of the city. But if I were the mayor, I'd be like, you know what, you guys do this. You be in charge of this and that and this and that. And when it goes bad, my commercial will be, it wasn't me. It was Eric Zorn. He was in charge of the police.
Well, but I mean, just to get to talk about Eddie's point here. Okay, so you've got, I mean, I'll just take an example. Like, say your garbage bins in the alley, okay? And now when your garbage bin goes missing or the lid breaks, you call the ward office. The alderman sends somebody out with a new bin. The alderman is accountable. You're grateful to the alderman and so on. If there's a central office of garbage bin replacements and it's not that efficient, if it takes a week or a month to get a new bin, you're still probably going to take it out on the alderman, right? You're still going to like, oh, I can't get anything done. I want new leadership in the city. And I think that gets to the whole thing with the mayor also. It's like, if you're going to be held accountable for this, then you at least want to have some responsibility for it. I think where that whole point is going.
Yeah. Well, and some things on the constituent services side have been centralized back to the city and away from the alderman. I would be so interested to see the change of requests for things like potholes and garbage pickup and lights going out. How many of them were going through aldermanic offices and how many of them were going directly to 311 at the city?
And this was a big debate when they changed the way garbage pickup routes were done, where the garbage pickup routes were very inefficient because they had to follow ward boundaries. And when they broke free of that, it made it a lot easier to pick up the garbage for the sanitation haulers. But it made the aldermen very nervous because they no longer were able to control when garbage got picked up, and they couldn't answer their constituents' phone calls. And you're right, you know, so much of being an alderman is like I say, being a task rabbit, potholes and garbage cans and things like that.
You know, this conversation started out about whether or not they should be able to earn outside income. Should they recruit themselves? Should it be absolute and just say, no, you're either a city council person or you are not. You can't even run the proverbial lemonade stand that Eric talked about. That part of the conversation reminds me a little bit about what Raja Krishnamurthy is trying to push through Congress, where members of Congress can't trade on stocks. When they get information about pending legislation or how something they're going to do might impact certain companies and their stocks, it's tantamount to insider trading. And they do it all the time. They did it just before and after the pandemic started with pharmaceutical companies or other companies that might suffer. They got in or they got out, or members of their families did. So Raja's pushing a bill that would make it illegal. They would not be able to buy or sell stocks. So their families would not be able to cash in on what they knew. And that is going nowhere. the Congress has no appetite to pass that. And in both cases, in the city of Chicago or in the Congress, it's kind of a matter of trust, right? You'd like to think that they wouldn't essentially trade on inside information other people don't have access to. But in either case, I think underlining all of this is you just don't trust them. You don't trust them to do what's ethically right.
I do want to point out, I think that Alderman Vasquez's proposal about outside income does specify that it is only to do with
real
jobs
estate
that have conflicts. It doesn't. You can drive a cab or sell lemonade at the farmer's market.
Yeah, but most of them aren't doing that. Most of them are, and I don't know what the 80. Could you categorize for us what most of the city council people's jobs are? I would imagine it would be legal services and having something to do with construction or real estate.
Yeah, most outside gigs are working as attorneys. And if I'm remembering correctly, they do not have to disclose what type of law they practice. But there's some who just do family law, and then there's some like Ed Burke who do real estate. And then, of course, there are some who had government consulting gigs where they would lobby other units of government. And that is that's been going away for some time. That was like one of the first things to go. But we also have to remember that like sometimes elected officials just take bribes, and it's not them pushing side businesses or doing things in council to benefit themselves. It's just, hey, give me $5,000 and I will get this liquor license taken care of for you.
Yeah, you mentioned $5,000, and that was the amount that Emil Jones III is alleged to have taken from the red light camera company. And the Sun Times wrote a pretty funny editorial basically going like, $5,000? You sold out for $5,000?
I know. If I'm going to risk going to jail, you need to give me a lot more money than that.
Yeah, come on. 50,
well,
okay.
Yeah. I texted a lot of people about that amount, and they were like, well, that suggests that it's so commonplace for that. And I'm not suggesting anything specific, but that it might be so commonplace for some people to kind of trade. You sponsor this event and I'll sponsor this piece of legislation, that you kind of lose sight of what is peddling, what counts as bribery, and what you consider normal business.
If we also then are reminded how endemic the corruption is, that is, for a $5,000 bribe, you might get this contract or that legislation or that bill passed or whatever. Do we spend enough time criticizing the people that are paying the bribes, the companies or the individuals or whoever needs something? We always look at these city council members or state legislators as corrupt or corruptible. But what about all of the people that are the other part of that deal, all the construction companies or radio stations or whatever it is that have some dealing they want, and they want favorable action, and so they takes two to tango here.
Well, they do prosecute them, don't they, AD? They're people who are prosecuted for giving bribes.
ComEd number one.
Yeah, sure.
ComEd, right.
No, that's example number one right now. But I just think in general, this idea that the politicians are the corrupt ones and all of us are the victims ignores the fact that all of us who need favors are ready to write checks to these corrupt politicians. The general populace is probably per person is corrupted or corruptible. Well, this is kind of philosophical now, as the politicians themselves.
But my guess is, John, in some of these cases, the reason that the politicians are prosecuted and not the ones who give the bribes is that the ones who give the bribes are offered some sort of a deal to testify.
Yeah.
And you want, you know, as bad as those people are for doing that, you don't want your politicians taking bribes, and you'd rather they're the bigger fish here. They're the ones that you really want to get. They're the ones you want to make an example of. So it may be that we're skewed more toward prosecuting politicians over the bribees rather than the bribers, there's probably some understandable reasons for that. But as AD points out, the ComEd case is a great example of people being in the dock for offering bribes. So it does happen.
And part of what's also important to understand is who's doing the leaning. So are aldermen or other elected officials saying, you know, if you did this, I could do this. So who is making the ask is also important to keep in mind, and that we entrust politicians with our vote and with our tax dollars essentially to be trustworthy people. And when they don't, they're violating like an essential proponent of our democracy. We don't hold corporations to the same standard.
I'll circle way back to a point that I made about when Rod Blagojevich got that horribly long sentence. Everyone was saying, oh, it's so long, it's terrible. And I said, we trusted Rod Blagojevich. Yeah, I mean, the crimes he was convicted of just on their face were not maybe 14 years worth, but the voters put him in a position of great trust, and he violated that trust. And that is a serious, serious offense, I think, much more so than if somebody at ComEd violates whatever trust that person has. That when the governor of the state violates trust like that, he deserves to get punished severely. And so I was not troubled by that 14-year sentence. And now I've taken the conversation back 12 years or so. So we can bring it back up to
the current. I don't mind. It relates. Okay. And besides, I think that were he here today, Governor Blagojevich would still say, I think he still is saying, that it's not pretty clear that he did anything different than everybody else is doing. We haven't really clearly drawn the line between what's illegal and what's lobbying. He thought he was, at least he says, maybe he actually believes this. He was playing by the rules, Pac.
No. I mean, we could spend an hour talking about that. He was a sleazy guy, and what he did was way beyond the bounds of just sort of normal.
You're talking about holding up the children's hospital?
Yeah, this normal political horse trading is how he put it. But I mean, I don't want to rehash that case necessarily, but I just want to say that those kind of offenses are serious, and the higher up you are, the more grave they are.
One of my jobs here is to plug good things that people should listen to and read to learn more about this stuff. I will go ahead and plug Public Official A from WBEZ, where you can hear some of the conversations that Rob Blagojevich was having about influence peddling and selling seats, etc.
You know, we used to play a lot of those clips when those tapes were released. And the one that still sticks in my mind, besides "This Thing is Golden," everybody knows that one. But it's when J.B. Pritzker was pining for a position. And he was so eager to fall into Blagojevich's good graces. And Blagojevich said, "Well, you're an attorney, aren't you?" And he says, "You know, maybe attorney general." And then JB goes, "Hey, yeah." He didn't want to be attorney general, but he was just kind of playing the governor the way the governor was playing him. You could see he was so eager for a position of influence or office in government. Did you see the Rolling Stones list of 100 greatest TV shows of all time? It's the 100 greatest TV shows of all time. This isn't the first time they've done it. And these lists always come out, sometimes almost intentionally, with some things in there to tweak everybody to get them talking about it. And I guess one logical question to ask is there anything that is glaringly in there that shouldn't be or has been omitted that should have been on that list?
I didn't immediately identify any ones that weren't on there. Selfishly, I'm like a lifelong Law & Order SVU fan, but completely understand why Law & Order SVU would not make a list like this when I see everyone else that's on it. Frasier's on here. Golden Girls are on here. All of my favorite comedies are on here. I feel like NBC really dominates this list, but I want to hear Eric's rant about what's not on here that should be, or a too low ranking that should be fought over.
I really, really liked Fleabag, the Phoebe Waller-Bridge's thing. Yes. I thought that was a terrific show. I was really sorry that she ended it.
It ended perfectly, though.
Oh, it did. It did. It ended perfectly. It was an exquisite show from the beginning to the end, from the shocking opening.
Is it on the list?
It's five. As much as I love that show, I don't think it's better than Seinfeld, which is six. Fleabag is five. Seinfeld is six. Little things like that in the list that jump out. And there were also, we talked about, there were the omissions that I mentioned. You don't have Roseanne, you don't have Louie, you don't have the Cosby Show because of the problematic things. I thought that the idea that The Good Fight made the list, but The Good Wife, the show before it, that really set the table for the
totally agree. Totally agree with you on that.
It was a very strange thing. But you know, they put out these lists every few years to get people arguing, and it helps radio talk show hosts.
Yeah, hey, that was a half hour of my day, so that worked out for
me. Fill the lonely hour. Well, so AD, nothing you saw in that list, even in the rankings.
I'm always surprised how. Like Thursday night NBC things ranked. So like 30 Rock beat The Office, beat Parks and Rec, beat the original UK. Like the original UK Office was one of the lowest ranked ones on there, which I know is like a big bone of contention between like OG UK Office fans and NBC English Steve Carell Office fans. I was surprised 30 Rock. I love 30 Rock, but I was surprised it beat out all those other ones, and that The Good Place beat a lot of those too.
I was glad to see The Good Place on there, though.
Definitely. And it's always interesting to, like, I would have loved to see which ones got kicked out in favor of more recent shows. So, like, The Crown is on here. What did The Crown replace? The Crown is excellent, but what did it?
And The Crown is the 88th place, so it just made the list. I'll give you two shows. Which one is substantially higher or lower on the list? The Crown is 88. Lost is 35. I can't imagine The Crown being 88. That show was just so well done. I thought it was terrific. The other thing that I thought as I was going through this, like I'm saying, wait a minute, why is Newhart 86? But then I looked at the 85 in front of it, and they were all pretty good shows too. I don't think there was any ones that were like terrible on this list or really miscast. I did think Will and Grace should have made the list somehow. I thought St. Elsewhere, I couldn't believe St. Elsewhere wasn't on the list. I expected to see that in the top 25. And The Cosby Show, I'm really surprised they didn't put it in there, because I know why we don't like Bill Cosby, but we did like the show, and we did like the people on the show, and I think it was a transitional show. I think it really did reset the landscape, maybe the way Will and Grace did. Why isn't The Cosby Show on there? It can't be because they're mad at Bill Cosby, Eric. It must be.
Of course it is. Of course it is. That's the only possible explanation.
But then you've got 99, you got 100 shows here for which we're going to judge the cast of, and none of them are Bill Cosby, but I'll bet we could find reasons to not like some people on this list and go, really? So that's what you want to go down that road?
You know, it just occurs to me. I didn't look. I don't have the list right in front of me. Sorry, I do have the list, but I do. Scroll through it. Is House of Cards on there?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
See,
no.
I thought that was a great show. And of course, Kevin Spacey had some Me Too problems, I think, he turned out to be a skeezy character. And so that show is not on the list. I really like the show This Is Us. Watched all the seasons of it. Thought it was really, really well done.
It's not on the list.
And I know it's not on the list, and I'm a little disappointed by it. But as I look down at there, are the shows that I think about. But I think it's fun to look at. Just to scroll down the list and forgetting the numbers, look at all the quality TV.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, years ago TV was, you know, Minow said it was a vast wasteland, and people would. If you watch TV, you were considered to be, you know, so too much. You were considered to be an anti-intellectual, and famous actors wouldn't want to go on TV because it was just TV. There's just terrific, terrific shows up and down this list.
I feel so privileged to be living in this era.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Of television.
It's the golden age of the medium, even if it's not on TV, even if they're not technically TV shows. I mean, you know.
John and I grew up watching F Troop and Gilligan's Island.
One show that I thought was interesting is Succession is number 11, so it's just outside the top 10. And Succession has been such a guilty pleasure for me. But I think all of these, and it's a
Why
well
guilty?
Done
show. Why are you guilty about it? That's a great show.
All the people are so miserable. You know, maybe I'm judging it. All of the people are so miserable and unhappy, and they deserve each other. And you watch it thinking, the reason I'm watching it is because I want bad. It's like hate watching. Mary Tyler Moore's number 10. You love Mary.
But I think beyond the likability of the characters, it's like a very important commentary on like news, wealth, family dynamics, so many other things that like, yes, these characters are a part of, but like the show is a broader commentary on like a lot of important things. And it's just so, so well done, and has, in a way that Barry has kind of also done, kind of mastered that, like, this can be funny and tragic and like very upsetting all at the same time.
And dark, yeah. Barry, you're talking about, yeah.
And I kind of like Shiv on Succession.
I know she's
a bit devious.
I know
she's devious, but I think she's
the daughter.
Yeah.
So just for, if you haven't seen the list, 11 is Succession. Mary Tyler Moore Show is 10. Atlanta from FX is 9. Cheers is 8. 7 is Mad Men. Seinfeld is 6. Fleabag is 5. I thought putting The Wire at 4 was, if not inspired, at least correct. We sure loved that. Then Breaking Bad, The Simpsons, and The Sopranos are the top 11 on the list. And 100 is What We Do in the Shadows, which I just think is, every episode is so fun, so smart, so funny. You know, it's these vampires, and it's a kind of a really well-done comedy vampire show. It's hilarious.
These lists sometimes have a real recency bias to them. And then that might explain why The Good Fight beat out The Good Wife, for instance.
One that I realized is not on here, because I was doing like a quick scroll through to be like, how much sci-fi representation is there on this list? Not a lot. Doctor Who is not on here. Twilight Zone is on here. Doctor Who is not on here.
I have not watched Doctor Who. Is that as good?
And Black Mirror is not on there either.
Maybe they're too British.
You know, one of the longest running shows in TV, It's Always Sunny, is 81st on the list. And I don't know if you guys watch that, but that's, talk about guilty pleasures. You go, okay, I know I shouldn't be laughing at this, but boy, this is really, these people do not care. One last topic real quick, guys, and then I'll let you go. Chicago police are joining a national wave of encrypting radio communication. Eric, you've been talking about this. You said it raises transparency concerns.
Well, they're encrypting their radio communications. You just summarized it. So that there are a lot of people out in the community who like to listen to radio transcriptions. There are a lot of journalists who like to listen to police radio to find out what's going on, to be there, to be on the scene of crimes. There were a number of cases where I know that Tribune reporters beat the cops to actual, you know, a police call will come in, and the Tribune reporters tends to be closer. So they're right there watching the police initial interaction with what's going on. And my guess is part of the reason is police don't like that. They don't want it to be the second person on the scene. They don't want that kind of oversight. AD, do you know what the justification for this was?
So basically, there were these rogue radio calls that CPD said were putting officers in danger. So it's basically outside users being able to interject comments and chatter over police traffic. And we've heard about this happening over like very confusing events. I think this happened possibly during the second round of looting. But a recent example was basically prank callers, although prank makes it seem rather light, calling in fake police emergencies using real life but old audio from past incidents. So they're basically saying we need to encrypt this so that it can't be hijacked by outside groups, which has happened recently.
What's the downside then? That seems to be a real problem. What's the problem with them encrypting it then?
Just like Eric said, it's, I think, news media, because we're all news media people, is number one. Being able to get to the scene quickly, being able to hear what officers are saying about that incident. And
yeah, but that's your problem.
Up.
That's a journalistic problem, which is...
Wait a minute. Any problem for journalists is a problem for our community.
Yeah, but so too, and any problem but any problem for the police to, as effectively as possible, do their job is a problem for the community too, right?
Largely speaking, yes, but not in this case. We're not talking about like reporters showing up and like moving a dead body or something. We're talking about reporters being there to observe what's going on, and that should not be a problem for police.
Well, what I was wondering was happening is, are people who are hearing these calls somehow interfering with the police, or maybe knowing where the police are and what they're working on, so now they're able to manage their crimes? I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's any compromise in the police's ability to do their job because these calls are so public.
The only explanation in the Trib article I read was that these rogue callers calling in. And there's some folks who say, you know, we should figure out some kind of... So the current workaround is basically that everyone that currently listens to Scanner Radio live will be able to hear it on a 30-minute delay on a separate website not operated by the city of Chicago. There are some who argue, hey, us reporters get our media credentials to be able to show up to things and get past whatever rope line there is because we have CPD media credentials. Why don't you guys set up a login so we could be listening to Scanners?
Maybe that'll happen, but that's not what's happening now. So it'll be encrypted, so you will not be able to listen in? I mean, think about how that compromises what you all do.
And not just reporters. The other people talked to in this Trib article was anti-violence workers who I have spoken to, and they're often like, I'm a lot of times the first person on the scene, and they use Scanners too to basically go and de-escalate basically as soon as they get there. So it's more than us. And then there's, you know, there are hobbyists that pay attention to Scanners and are tweeting things constantly.
Oh yeah.
And there have been times in the newsroom where they hear and tweet things before we hear and can respond to them. And sometimes you can pick those up on Twitter and go respond to a scene.
A couple of my listeners are always sending me audio clips from the police chatter. For instance, when it's a busy weekend and there's a two-hour delay on some 911 calls, and that appears in my email inbox on Monday mornings after busy weekends, my listeners just send me the audio. I guess I'm not going to be getting that much anymore, huh?
You could get it.
It'll be 30 minutes delayed. Yeah,
but
yeah.
people aren't going to be monitoring it for you if it's 30 minutes delayed. In all likelihood, it won't be nearly as compelling
for them to do that.
Oh yeah,
I would guess
it happened rather than it's happening right now. Eric, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right.
And that's all the time we have for the podcast today. We took more time than we normally do, 80, because we spent so much time on the video pre-roll, I think. But thanks for joining us today.
Of course, happy to.
It was really great. You're really good at this. I knew that from channel your stuff on Channel 11.
I used to be a radio person. I started out at WSBT in South Bend. I was a midday newscast person, and then I was on like the NPR track for a while until I started working at the Daily Line.
Then you're not regularly doing a podcast with somebody right now,
AD?
No,
and I had one at Cranes that I really enjoyed for an hour every week with like some kind of newsmaker, and it was very fun, but I had to book and mix and edit and script the whole thing by myself. So if Trib wanted to do it, I would be like, I need help.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really pleased to see the Tribune is getting into the podcast game finally.
Yeah,
Stacey St. Clair and Christy Gutowski have got this Tylenol series that's running concurrently with their print report on the Tylenol murders. And I'd listened to the first two episodes, and I'm a very fussy guy when it comes to podcasts, John, but I thought it was really, really well done. Very excellent production on it. So,
I listen to The Daily most mornings, the New York Times, which is the second most listened to podcast in the world, at least most of the time it is. And I get a little ticked because at the end they say, here's all the people that participated in this 38-minute podcast. It's like the Tonight Show.
People.
Oh, my God. Original music for this episode composed by. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
They had two composers, full time.
I know, full time. I thought, what a wonderful gig for them. And then they have like four editors. I'm going to edit this podcast myself now. You don't need four people to do that. You need me. I could do it. It's amazing and it's a great podcast, in part because they got the New York Times reporters on it. Jealous isn't the right word, but I realize how much we do with so much less. It just reminds me of how fortunate they are to have those resources.
Whenever an old editor would be mad at me about getting something done on time, I'd be like, it's just me. The Daily has 12 people, okay?
Yeah.
Right. Like every other show you're listening to has at least two.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it would be nice if the Tribune does keep going with podcasts, because your Cranes podcast was excellent, and maybe could pick that up again.
Thank you. Deal. Thanks, guys.
Okay, guys.
Nice to see you. Bye.
We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.